In his new book, The Medea Hypothesis, paleontologist Peter Ward tries to answer an extremely complicated scientific, some might even say philosophical, question. What is the nature of nature? The answer he comes up with, that life on Earth is ultimately self-destructive, might reshape how we think about the natural world and environmentalism. The book is published by Princeton University Press. I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
In the late 1970s, James Lovelock proposed the Gaia hypothesis, the idea that life sustains habitable conditions on Earth. Are you arguing the exact opposite?
Yeah, this is really anti-Gaia, and I got to meet Dr. Lovelock in Seattle during his book tour, handed him a copy of my book, and it was kind of like The Exorcist, where it was, it burns!
Well, in Greek mythology, Medea, who was married to Jason of the Argonauts, was upset that he'd left her for another woman, and he killed their children. How does that apply here?
She was a very bad mother. The Gaia hypothesis, Gaia is the Greek for the good mother, and she hasn't been a good mother. I come to this from the geological past, looking at rocks, and a colleague of mine said, well, you call it the Medea hypothesis. Maybe you ought to call it the Mr. Bean hypothesis, because nature and evolution just seems to blunder from one catastrophe to another.
Well, she was a matricide, right?
She did. Killed two of her children.
And are you saying that Earth is biocidal?
Earth is definitely biocidal. If we look at the cause of the deep past mass extinctions, it's Mother Earth who does it to herself.
But how does that work from an evolutionary standpoint? Why would life destroy itself?
Well, that's an interesting point. And what we see is when we have these near-destructive events, we have several lineages that squeak through, and quite often we get from those fires, novelty breaks out, but at lower levels of diversity.
What are some of the Medean events, as you call them, in the history of the Earth?
Well, even the origin of life is itself, as we know, shrouded in a lot of mystery, but the origin of photosynthesis was the first great catastrophe. Life up to that point had been in a no-oxygen environment. Now this new type of life starts producing oxygen, killing off virtually everything else on the planet. And we find this from step to step. Every great innovation leads to an immediate mass extinction.
So oxygen, which is the fuel of life, was the destroyer of life at one point? What is that, 2.5 billion years ago?
That's correct. And it was definitely a major, major destructive influence.
And how long did it take to get past that?
Well, we had other forms of life then squeaking out of that. And then right after this, we get, at the same time, this photosynthetic stuff starts taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and we go into the first of the great snowball Earths, where the Earth freezes from pole to pole, and this is definitely produced by life itself, and once again, we just kill off most of life on the planet.
Now, we're not talking about ice ages. We're talking about something much more powerful?
Way more powerful. All the oceans frozen, all the land surface covered with ice, a planet near death.
And then what happened? The ice melted?
Very slowly, volcanic activity starts spewing out enough CO2 that it lifts us out of this. And here we are again to another snowball about 600 million years ago.
Well, people have suggested that volcanic activity has caused mass extinctions and also, of course, the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs. Now, you wouldn't call those Medean events, would you?
Well, in a way, I would. The volcanic events, the short-term global warmings that come from a thing called flood basalts, where over a million years, huge areas get covered with basalt, produces heat. But the heat itself produces a change in the microbes in the ocean. The nice, happy oxygen microbes get replaced by anoxic microbes, which produce hydrogen sulfide, a great poison.
Now, can you explain those snowball Earth episodes? That's kind of like, Earth kind of looked like Titan, didn't it?
Oh, very much so. And the only place where life would have been able to survive would have been very cold life, psychrophile life, it's called, that sat in the ice. But around the volcanic heating centers, there would have been a little oases. And some of us think that the great variety of life on Earth, the Cambrian explosion, may have been really pushed into that. You get these separated little tiny oases in a very frozen planet.
Toxic algal blooms are being discovered all over the planet, including in fresh waterways in upstate New York. Haven't blooms of algae been tied to mass extinctions in the past?
Absolutely. And we're seeing the big five. The last 20 years, it's been very wonderful to think that impacts could have caused every one of these great mass extinctions, as it did killing the dinosaurs. And now we think that only the dinosaur event was caused by impact.
So that was a unique event. And the rest is just Earth going through its usual stuff.
Yes. And I've just come back from Antarctica, where we're looking at the right before the impact in Cretaceous-aged rocks, and we found there a signature of heating right below that, too.
So are you suggesting that those people who doubt climate change are really barking up the wrong tree?
Well, if you look at the deep past, every time we know what CO2 levels were in the past, we can measure these things. And why is it every time we have high CO2, high carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases, the planet heats up enormously? Life tells us this.
Does the increase in algal blooms today concern you?
Absolutely. And we're worried an awful lot about seagrass. Seagrass is dying out because of hydrogen sulfide. I live in around the Puget Sound area, and now old logging areas are just, after 200 years, coming to the surface as this poisonous hydrogen sulfide, and it's changing everything.
And the sea life is changing, isn't it?
Completely. The heating of the coral reefs right now, we're seeing coral death because of coral bleaching. But the most amazing thing, again, coming from the Antarctic waters and just watching what's happening down there. Again, I'm only a week out of that.
Now, you're suggesting that Earth has just gone through booms and busts, and that has been the natural cycle, not the Gaia cycle.
Yes, booms and busts. And the interesting aspect that I see is that there really is only one way out for any planet. I'd like to extend the Medea hypothesis not just to ours. Any planet with life, we're going to see the same sort of boom and bust and bigger bust. It takes intelligence to get you out of it, intelligence and engineering.
Well, all those other ones occurred without the help of humans, but it's been suggested that this latest one is totally our fault.
Well, there's certainly an awful lot of influence of humans producing coal-fired plants, and we're seeing now that we really do have to reduce these emissions. Just the sea level aspect, that's what scares me the most. CNN just came up with an idea. What would it cost to change the position of all the wharves where ships download or offload material? If sea level rises a meter, you've got to change every dock in the world. That's trillions of dollars.
Well, we know that Earth will eventually become uninhabitable when our sun enlarges into a red giant and then swallows it. But you're suggesting that we're going to be lifeless way before then?
Could be. I mean, the worst thing that's facing us, strangely enough, isn't too much carbon dioxide. We've got this short-term boom to deal with. But over long periods of time, life itself has been stripping carbon out of the carbon cycle. Anytime a coral reef builds big skeletons and then they get put on a continent and can't recycle. So we're seeing within probably 500 million to 1 billion years, there will not be enough carbon dioxide for plant life, and then there goes oxygen.
My guest is Peter Ward, who is a professor of biology and Earth and space sciences at the University of Washington, an astrobiologist with NASA. His book, The Medea Hypothesis, Is Life on Earth Ultimately Self-Destructive?, is published by Princeton University Press. Now, I want to get back to the Cambrian explosion. It's been said that nature bores a vacuum. So is that what happened? Most life disappeared, and then because the situation changed, a whole bunch of things took advantage of that?
Well, there's also planetary aspects. There could not be a lot of life until you had sufficient amount of oxygen, and it took a long time for this particular planet to build oxygen up where you could have animals. The result of that is this enormous explosion of life, but the result soon after becomes these periodic mass extinctions.
Well, some species like nautiluses, horseshoe crabs, crocodiles are called living fossils because they have not evolved much over the hundreds of millions of years they've been on Earth. I imagine there are some kinds of bacteria that haven't changed much either over billions of years. So can't we say life is pretty resilient despite all these Medean events?
But life that is of a living fossil might be one out of a million. And we celebrate
them. The cockroaches are the other one.
They're so rare compared to the millions of other species. My single greatest hope for humans is that we become a living fossil. There's nothing in our genes that will make us inherently go extinct. Just my genes are going to kill me. But as a species, that doesn't have to be the case. We can live like a living nautilus 500 million years.
In the past, it was nature doing it. In this case, we know we're doing it. Is that the big distinction, the big difference here?
Well, we're the curse and the blessing. This is the two-edged sword. Yes, right now, climate change is definitely going to cause a major change on this particular planet. I do not think we're going to stop it. I think we're going to see the sea levels rise. But on the other hand, we also have the ability to engineer this planet to keep us alive a lot longer than could have.
But didn't the Gaia principle wasn't also based on the idea that life is very adaptable? There are whole colonies of life around deep sea thermal vents, tube worms, bacteria, crabs, and shrimp all thrive in the ecosystems that are totally devoid of sunlight. So isn't it possible that as conditions on the planet change over billions of years, life will merely adapt and flourish in other ways?
Well, life will certainly adapt, but the Gaian hypothesis also suggests that if we could only go back to nature, if we humans could only give it all back and let nature take over, we will be taken care of. And it's that point of view, I think, which is completely wrong and wrongheaded.
Now, there was a 100-million-year decline in carbon dioxide, and now people are worried that we have this increase in carbon dioxide. When will we reach the levels we had 100 million years ago?
We are certainly going to be there, I think, by the end of the century. Some people think even faster. What's going to happen is when the Arctic sea ice finally, as early as 2015, but perhaps as late as 2030, when that is gone,
it's going to be totally gone?
Yes, and when it's gone, you're going to have an open seaway through there. That dark water will absorb so much more heat, and even The Economist in his 2010 issue said that will be the great kickstart to the global warming and the sea level rise that I think is the greatest threat to humanity.
And we'll probably see a lot of extinctions, won't we? The polar bear, the most obvious one.
Well, the big extinctions, yes.
And krill? I'm
much more worried about what's going on in terms of acidification. The northern cold waters take up CO2. It becomes acidic. And even right now, there are mollusks called pteropods, which are losing their shells, dissolved right off their back. That's the base of the food chain in the Arctic.
A number of books in this decade have been published that accuse humans as being the main culprit for the planet's destruction, from Derek Jensen's Endgame, which suggests that the destruction of civilization would save the planet, to Alan Weisman's The World Without Us, which wonders how the natural world would adapt to the environment if we just left. What do you make of this line of thinking about our relationship to the environment?
I think it's nonsensical. I think in this particular case, we're not going to go away. This whole hope, the Alan Weisman business, if only we would go away, see what happens. But we're not going to go away. The aspect is that we're not going to give up civilization. We're not going to give up our energy-producing ways. And so we have to adapt to it.
We did a show a while back on some of the geoengineering proposals that have been made. Some theories have proposed that we pump the upper atmosphere full of sulfur dioxide. Others would like to try carbon sequestration, and some have gone as far as to suggest firing thousands of disks into space to partially block out the power of the sun.
Yeah, the worst of those, of course, is Paul Crutzen's, although he won a Nobel Prize, his idea to put that sulfur in the atmosphere is biosuicidal. You're still going to have all the acid going into the oceans. That one's just not going to fly.
That would give us acid rain?
Acid rain everywhere. It's just such a wrong-headed way to go. On the other hand, it is through similar types of engineering, not the sulfur in the atmosphere. But I think the recession that we just saw and the reduction in CO2 tells us that it is going to be conservation. It's going to be many different sources of energy that save us.
But many people were hopeful when the Copenhagen Climate Conference began. Do you think that there'll be a certain sense of desperation and we'll be hearing more of these geoengineering proposals because the conference didn't come up with a meaningful binding agreement?
Well, we'll drive everybody to finally do something. We'll be, first of all, the great droughts and the loss of water from the Himalayas, because we're now seeing that climate change is producing glaciers that are ever higher, and we get the greatest drought of the last 100 years, as I understand it, is in parts of China. The same is going to happen in the Sierras. We don't have regular snowfall. We won't have a snowpack. And that will drive us, the famines produced by these will drive us to change.
In the previous segment, we talked about how China has been doing so many things right. And then you came in and said, well, not for the environment.
No, they're doing so many things wrong in the sense that, well, how can I say I drive a car? As it is now, 1 out of 100 Chinese have a car. Who's to say that they can't have as many cars in garages as Americans do? As you know, there's more cars in America than Americans. And yet one.
And I don't even have one.
Well, you live in the city where you don't need them.
Some people are getting my car.
Well, my city, Seattle, was built later than yours. It's a place where you have to have a car. And we are going to have to really revolutionize the way we build cities.
Later this week, I'll be speaking to a few geologists who propose injecting excess carbon dioxide deep into basalt rock formations off the coast of New York City. They say this process will turn the rock into limestone. Is that a project you might favor?
It's a project that could work, but in every single one of these, you have to look at how much energy does it take to produce the gain. You are putting CO2 in the atmosphere to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere. Is it a zero-sum game, or are you actually making progress?
Well, you write that the rate of which limestone forms on the surface of the Earth has important consequences for long-term climate. Why is that?
Limestone is simply small skeletons of lots of organisms taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. Again, over the period of the Earth's long habitability, it's the long-term reduction of that which will doom life on this planet. And it's a simple engineering, global engineering, to keep a balance of carbon dioxide. So we have within it, technically, to be able to go on many hundreds of millions of years into the future.
Are you suggesting that we must transcend our Medea-ness in order to save the planet?
Yeah, it's interesting enough, we have to become the first Gaians. I mean, there's a certain amount of gallows humor to me about this, but we have to do what the Gaians hope that nature would do and should do, but to me cannot do.
There's a part in the book where you compare the way humanity behaves with its environment to microbes. Well, how are we similar?
Microbes, when they get tired of being in bad conditions, instead of changing something about their body, they change the chemistry around them. They simply change the water chemistry or the air chemistry. That's what we humans do. It isn't so much evolution through a new arm or a leg. It is evolution of changing our atmosphere and our oceans. And we have to really understand that we can do it for good as well as evil.
You talked about the Chinese population and automobiles. Is overpopulation around the world part of this problem?
That's the greatest single threat. We're at 6.5 billion. We're going to 11 billion this century, if all predictions are true, and even 9.5 billion. We're going to have a third more people and a third less food.
Well, humanity, seems to me, finds itself in a bit of a paradox. In order to build a politically stable world with less warfare, we would want to spread economic prosperity, but doing that requires burning fossil fuels or the creation of nuclear waste. Do you think that the answer to our problems lie in coming up with another kind of technology?
Well, part of that is Craig Venter, who I think at the same time is both the most dangerous and probably the greatest savior that humanity could have. Craig Venter is the man who did the human genome. He's also working now at engineering microbes. We need two things. We need fuel. We need food. Food and fuel from engineered microbes might be the greatest hope for us.
Do we understand enough about our climate system to manage it properly?
I don't think so. But on the other hand, we understand enough to know that doing what we're doing now is going to lead to catastrophe. Sea level rise again. A meter by the end of the century doesn't sound like much, but then it keeps increasing. You have so much food right now within that 1 meter.
Peter Ward will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org. His book, The Medea Hypothesis, Is Life on Earth Ultimately Self-Destructive, is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.